The Ray D'Arcy Show on RTE Radio 1 with All Care Pharmacy. Expert advice to keep the whole family healthy at All Care, the largest Irish-owned pharmacy brand.
Oh, Ray at RTE.ie. Are those snails good for slow cooking? If I don't... We were talking to Sonia and Brendan yesterday about sustainable fashion, and I mentioned a book that I'm reading called Fashionopolis: The Price of Fast Fashion and the Future of Clothes. And the author of that book, Dana Thomas, is on the line. How are you doing, Dana?
I'm fine, thank you. How are you, Ray?
Good. Congratulations on the book.
Thank you.
Yeah, it's a scary read, and as I think you use the line somewhere, I won't be casual about how I wear clothes anymore, or buy clothes in particular. One, just for our listeners, just to let them know that the number of garments produced globally has more than doubled in the last 20 years. And that's mainly because of what you describe as fast fashion. So will you explain to us what fast fashion is and how it came about, please?
Yes, fast fashion is trendy clothes made in vast amounts in far-flung factories at lightning speed and then sold in thousands of stores worldwide for super cut rate prices. And it's been around for about 30 years. And because it's so cheap and they're changing on the floor all the time, they've created a frenzy among consumers where we've become addicted to shopping and we come out with sacks full of clothes. And because they're cheap, we don't invest any value to them. And the average garment today, because of this, is worn seven times before it's thrown away. Seven.
Seven times. So it's as well as fast fashion, it's disposable fashion.
It's throwaway clothes. Our landfills are heaving with clothes. 99% of garments today are not recycled. Only 1% are recycled. So we just toss these clothes in the bin because we're like, I already paid 9 or 10 pounds for it, so what?
Yeah.
And most of the time it doesn't break down. It doesn't biodegrade. So we're creating a crust around the world on the planet Earth of just... cheap clothes.
So we'll come back to the sustainability and the effect it's having on the planet in a moment, but I'm just interested to find out, you know, our thinking. So do we throw them away because they're so cheap or because they're not very good quality or a bit of both?
A bit of both. Right. I mean, one fashion executive told me the best that dress will look, a fast fashion dress will look, is the first time you wear it. As soon as you put it in the wash, it'll lose its oomph, its color, its shape, its whatever. It may shrink. So they're badly made. I mean, they're not badly made because the people who make them are doing a bad job, but because they're made of cheap materials. And the poor people who are making them are paid pennies. I mean, that's the other horrible part of this equation, that, you know, often Bangladesh and Vietnam and Honduras, you know, if something costs you 10 pounds, it means that the person who made it was paid 10 cents.
Okay. So the profits among the people who own the likes of Zara and H&M.
Enormous.
Enormous. Like
gigantic.
Billions.
Some of the richest people in the world. Billions. The man who owns Zara at one point was the second richest person in the world after
Ortega,
after Bill Gates. After Bill Gates.
Right. And they're making their money on the backs of bad working conditions.
On the fingers. The nimble and worn out fingers of
okay.
You know, we talk about wealth, you know, and inequality and disparity, you know, that there's the 1% or the 0.1% who are super uber rich making all their money off the poor around the world. And the fast fashion industry is an extreme but perfect example of how this works.
Okay.
This is it, right, in a snapshot.
In a nutshell, yeah. So originally we would have sourced our materials locally, and some people would have made their own clothes or else a friend would
Absolutely.
Have made them. It was all very local and sustainable.
My mother made my clothes
Did
for
she?
Me when I was little.
Yes. And even in my lifetime, and I'm 55, even the clothes...
Me too.
Yeah, right.
How about that?
With the 64 Club. Even, like, we would have... My mother would have been expert at patching our clothes. So
absolutely.
If you've got a pair of jeans...
And I do.
Yes.
I have jeans from
them.
The 80s.
Do you?
And,
right.
And my teenager has found them and is wearing them and thinks they're super uber cool.
Yeah.
And she says, these are boyfriend jeans. I said, no, honey, they are the original mom jeans.
Yeah. So that was the way it was done. So it has changed, as you say, in the last 25, 30 years. So... Let's talk then about what you mentioned already. You travelled to Bangladesh.
I did.
The book, you outline a number of disasters. Spectrum Sweater in 2005. That's it. Sportswear in 2010. And then the biggest of them all, Rana Plaza in 2013 in Bangladesh, where 1,134 workers lost their lives.
Yes.
So describe the conditions that you witnessed. When did you go there? Was it last year?
Yeah, last year for the fifth anniversary of the Rana Plaza collapse, I went for about a week to Bangladesh and I visited sweatshops. I visited some factories, a factory that had been renovated under the new accord that for fire and safety that, you know, tries to avoid things like the Tazreen fire and Rana Plaza by, you know, shoring up the building and fixing all the infractions. And then I visited the Rana Plaza site and I went to the homes, which, you know, the shanty shacks of survivors, some who were bedridden, and spoke with them about the horror of that collapse and what they went through afterward. And the reverb is, you know, really, really horrible. You know, people who are bedridden or still suffer from PTSD, but they had to go back and work in garment factories because that's the only work there is, and really tough.
And
really
did
tough.
They get compensation?
No.
Okay.
Very few people got compensation. It was a real, you know, gauntlet to get through in order to get the compensation. And so many of them were so wounded, they couldn't do it.
Go back. So when you went there last year, when you went into the factories who are making clothes that will end up in high street shops all over the world.
And in the bin or
in
landfill.
The bin, yes, yeah. What are their working conditions like?
In the sweatshops? Oh, yeah. They're miserable. And they're kids. You know, I saw kids who were 14, 15 years old working barefoot, you know, on unfinished wooden floors with fabric everywhere. I mean, the place looked like a fire could start at any minute. The filth was unfathomable. It was supremely hot, more than 100 degrees. They had fans blowing all the air and dust around. You know, it was just...
How much were they paid?
They were using old... They're paid, you know, I think... I don't know how much in the sweatshops. In regular factories, they're paid, the state late wage at the time was $68 a month.
Right.
And you know, the sweatshop, it's probably less.
Bangladesh, its economy is sort of mainly built on making clothes.
It is.
So there's a population of 168 million, nearly a quarter of them, 40 million.
Actually, I got that figured. There's a typo there. It's 4 million.
Oh, it's 4 million. Right. There you go. Right. I was thinking that's this typo there, right?
But still, okay. 4 million is pretty
4 million
much.
People. And then they produce $30 billion worth of clothes annually.
Yeah.
I suppose people would argue that if you pull that business out, that then those people would be poorer and unemployed. But what you would say is then we need to put... condition, we need to put regulations in place.
Yeah, those people should go see how those people are working first, and then they can make their judgment. No, that's what I thought, okay? I went there and I said, surely it can't be that bad. Well, it was worse than I ever imagined. Mm-hmm. And what we're doing is, okay, maybe we're pulling them out of extreme poverty, but still to poverty. They are not living middle-class lives, at least not the kind that you and I imagine. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they get stuck in a cycle because they aren't making a living wage. Only 2% of people who work in the garment industry making clothes today earn a living wage. Now, 2%, you go, right, all right, that's going to be the U.S., the U.K., France, Italy, you know, across Europe. But that means most everybody else is not. And a living wage means you earn enough to clothe, house, and feed yourself and your family. And they can't do it. So you're not helping them. You're actually trapping them in a really dysfunctional cycle that they, you know,
they're
working and they can't pay. They can't even pay to put food on the table.
But
then they have to do four of these jobs.
Yeah, the companies who pay the owners of these sweatshops to produce these clothes, they're complicit in all of this.
Absolutely. Like the factory owners. And they don't want to have to invest in remediation, you know, to fix the infractions in factories because that costs money. They don't want to pay the workers more because that cuts into their profits.
Office, yeah.
And, you know, it's...
But then what,
you know,
about,
these aren't good,
what about
these
further
aren't
up
good
the line?
Jobs
what about
on
further
top
up the line, Dana? What about further up the line? What about further up the line? The people who are, you know, ordering the clothes from these, the people who are in the UK or Ireland or America who are ordering the clothes from these. Where do they come into the whole thing?
Well, that's why I wrote the book, because most folks don't know. I mean, I thought I knew and I didn't know. And I've been writing about the fashion industry for 30 years.
Yeah.
So that's exactly why I wrote the book. I wanted people to understand how their clothes are made, where they're made, what goes into it from, you know, as we say, field to form or, you know, dirt to storefront, store floor. You know, that what it takes to grow and cotton today, that, you know, 99% of the cotton that we have today is GMO. There's only 1% that's organic. That, you know, jeans are a really filthy business where, you know, the finishing process. You and I, we used to buy our jeans stiff and hard, remember?
Yes.
Shrink to fit.
Yeah.
And it'd take you 6 months to wear them before you could sit down in them. Well, then, you know, we got pre-washed jeans, which are, and
so they have to be
jeans.
Pre-washed somewhere, and that takes a lot of water, and then there's pollution involved.
A lot of water, yeah. And that water does, unlike our washing machine, does not necessarily go through a treatment plant, and it gets dumped into rivers and kills. And, you know, there's just okay. All these different things that you don't know about and I don't know about, because when we were young, we always knew people in the business. But now it's all offshore. It's so far away. It's out of sight, out of mind, and we don't really think about it. So I wanted to call attention to it and say, you know what? We need to think about it.
Pollution is the cheapest way to do business.
It surely is.
That's a quote in your book. Yeah. So the sustainability, from reading the book, it sounds like the way we're going at the moment is not sustainable.
No, it's not sustainable. For loads of reasons.
Yes.
All sorts of reasons. And, you know, this is a book about fashion, but in fact, it's not. I could have written this book about widgets.
It's about consumerism.
But widgets are a lot less sexy.
No, it's about consumerism. We're reaching peak consumerism. But I suppose people listening want to know, what can they do? Like, you know, if you go, like, people now, you know, buy clothes for a Friday night and they may not wear
well,
it.
Well,
that's unheard
of. We didn't used to do that.
No.
Remember? Yeah. You went in your closet and you found something from Friday night Friday night, and you just changed it up a bit with a scarf or a brooch or a different jacket or a sweater, or, you know, you changed it up, but you had basics.
But the fast fashion genie is out of the bottle now. And to ask people, particularly a younger generation who know nothing different, to go back to a time when they had, you know, two pairs of jeans as opposed to, I don't know, somebody upstairs said they might have 40 pairs of jeans.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah.
Well, you know, here's the thing. One of the biggest moments, the aha moment I had when I was working on the book, was that I kept reading and people kept telling me, you know, clothes have never been cheaper, clothes have never been cheaper, clothes have never been cheaper. And I'm like, what do you mean? Then I read this piece from 1940 talking about a middle market line during the Depression. And those clothes cost the same amount as high street clothes today. At the height of the Depression, the worst economic period known in our modern era, clothes cost, not adjusted for inflation, but the same amount. Between $16 and $19.99, you know, a piece. But, and I thought, how can that be? Gasoline has gone up how much? And meat and houses have gone up so much, but clothes cost the same. So I thought, right, what we need to do is stop buying, like I said in the very beginning, 10 at $10 a piece or 10 euros a piece or 10 pounds a piece, but buy one for 100.
Yeah, people
and then
aren't
you
gonna
keep
do
it longer. Yeah. You love it. You care about it. You invest in it. Yeah. You could put value into it. You cherish it.
But Dana, that's a big ask for people. That's a huge ask. You know, and people, if they sat down, and very few people would do this, and they did the maths on it, well, I bought that this week and that week, and they if they added it up over a couple of months, they'd, oh yeah, I did spend that much. But, you know, they love the buzz, and that's part of it as well. The buzz, the adrenaline rush of buying something new. Mm-hmm. And you're depriving people of that as well. And then you add to the fact...
But that's a new buzz, and it's
a weird
addiction.
Yeah,
it's
and then
bit,
online shopping, there's another buzz
addiction.
As well. Yeah, I don't know. Like, it's a scary read, hugely interesting. And it's, you know, I love the bits on the history of the pair of jeans as well. That's fascinating as well.
Thank you. And there's some really basic, simple things we can do, like just wash our clothes less, and then they'll last longer.
Mm.
And we'll use less energy and water. The man from Procter & Gamble told me, you should wash your clothes less. He wants us to wash our clothes. And he said, wash them less and do it on the cold cycle, the short cycle, because you're saving money, you're saving energy, you're saving water, your clothes aren't getting destroyed, they last longer. I was like, right, well, that's a really easy solution to some of our problems.
Yeah, I'm sorry about this, but Dana, and you talk to lovely people, you know, who are doing it the right way and sourcing it locally and using all organic products. And then and I was going, oh, this is lovely. And then you say a T-shirt for $400, you know, and that's way out of most people's price range.
Right.
You know, so, and the other thing is that Amazon are now into fashion. That's interesting. So it's going to ramp up things, isn't it?
Well, what I hope is this book's going to have an effect on the fashion industry like Fast Food Nation did on the fast food and the food industry. Right. You know, when Fast Food Nation came out, farm-to-table restaurants weren't, that wasn't even a thing. And, you know, organic food was really expensive, and everyone kept saying, you know, how I can't afford, you know, the $10 tomato. Right, of course. And there were very few farmer markets. But what happened was that it sort of challenged everybody to stop buying fast food and maybe slowly start investing or looking at or working or also getting people into the business of slow fashion. So then the price comes down. So what I'm hoping is there'll be a leveling out, that organic cotton shirts won't cost $400. They'll drop down to, say, $80. And meanwhile, we'll be buying less of the $2 shirt.
Okay. And would you be hopeful about a younger generation who are a lot more aware of the future of our planet than we were?
Yes, it's the millennials who are driving all this. God bless them. Yeah. And even the younger ones. It's just great. The beauty of something like buying the organic T-shirt, which then sort of sews it back to my original idea of the farm-to-table movement, is that when you have an organic cotton shirt, when it finally does wear out and you've worn it to death because it's so great, it's so soft, it's such a, you, as soon as you put it on, you feel the difference. Then you can put it in your compost and put it in your garden and it'll feed your roses. So, you know, there's something really... You know, they talk about the false economy. We think we're saving money, but we're not actually saving money when we buy something cheap. Someone along the way is getting ripped off, but then we're also having to pay in other ways. And it's other ways that we don't think about, like that it doesn't biodegrade, that there's no place for the landfills, that it's ruining our water system, and then we have to pay more to fix the water system. All these different things come out of our pockets in the end.
It's a fascinating read, and let's hope... It does what you say it'll do.
Fashionopolis,
the price of fast fashion and the future of clothes.
We call it the Book of Hope, so here we go.
Right, Dana Thomas, been a real pleasure talking to you. Thanks so much.
You too, bye.
The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1.